Welcome to the Distance to Empty podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Goldberg, and I'm here with my co-host, Peter Noyes. This is the podcast where we dive into the world of 200-plus mile ultramarathons and talk about them obsessively with you guys. Peter, how are you doing today?
I'm doing better than I have been the past few days. We had a bit of a work crisis, and I was on a conference call that lasted over 60 hours, so I basically did like a 200 of fixing problems at work.
Yeah, that's I've never heard of a call that lasts that long. You were in it for like over 24 hours straight at one point, right?
That's correct.
Oh God, that is an ultramarathon of a work call. So did you get a buckle when it ended?
I'll ask about that. That's a great idea. Yeah, get buckles.
a little recognition, like obviously not the sub 24 buckle, but you know, maybe a buckle nonetheless.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Well, I hope you get some rest this weekend and can catch up, because that's insane.
Yeah. What about you? How's your training going?
Yeah, on the flip side, I had a lower volume week for the first time in like 5 or 6 weeks, and it was really well-timed and needed. We got like 18 inches of snow on Thursday, Friday, so it was nice to not have to do like massive mileage in the snow.
Are you marked safe from the snow?
I am. I shoveled probably like 90 minutes Thursday and another 90 minutes or so Friday, and it was really difficult. It was like super heavy wet snow, so my upper body is sore. But so next 3 weeks, 4 weeks here or so, building to Cocodona into mid-April, will be probably the biggest weeks of training I've ever done. My plan is to stack together a few 100-mile weeks, 110-mile weeks, which, you know, I've certainly hit those numbers before, but I don't think I've ever, like, stacked them back to back to back. So a little anxious, but mostly just excited about that. Like, it's fun to kind of be in a groove and be putting in the work, and the body's feeling really good. So, yeah.
Great. All right. So what do we have today?
Today we have another race director. I should say race directors, two of them. We have the race directors for Go Beyond Racing. They are the RDs who put on the Oregon 200, which is now coming up on its second year. So last year was its inaugural year. And this is a race that immediately caught my attention, because I just love that area of the country, like Oregon and Washington Pacific Northwest. I've done one of their races, one of Go Beyond's races, at Mountain Lakes 100 back in September of 2022, I believe. And it was just really well put on, very pretty race. So as soon as this race came on my radar, I was immediately interested. So wanted to reach out and get them on the podcast. And yeah, really excited to chat all things Oregon 200 with them. So let's get to it. Todd, Renee, welcome to Distance to Empty. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Our pleasure.
Yeah, we're excited to chat all things Oregon 200 today. Kick us off, can you kind of introduce yourselves and just tell us sort of how you came to the sport of ultra running, trail running, and what led you guys to forming Go Beyond Racing and becoming race directors?
Sure. Do you want to
go ahead?
So I think, like a lot of us, we ran roads and did shorter running, a lot of races before we jumped into trail running. But we both did adventure racing and a lot of off-road type racing. And that sort of led to longer trail running kind of events. And that's what how it kind of transitioned for us. I don't have any glorious stories about victories or podiums or anything like that, but that kind of transition. And 2009, I moved to Portland, Oregon, and I didn't have a job when I moved to Portland, and a friend of mine was helping to put on an ultra near Portland, and I jumped in and helped her do that. And that just kind of kicked it off. We put on that race for a few years, and that sort of led to some folks that I worked with before were developers, and we came up with started a timing company, chip timing company, that had social media update live updates. So back then, I don't think there was Instagram, but it was like Twitter, Facebook, and texting and email. When you hit a split or finished, it would immediately populate the social media channels that you selected. And we did that and started timing a bunch of races. And at the same time, you know, I was always interested in putting on our own races. And so we put on a couple of races, the Portland Trail Series, and then took over the Mount Hood 50. And then soon realized that putting on the races was a lot more fun than timing the races. So we transitioned from the company we had before called Inspire to start Go Beyond Racing in 2013 and have been kind of adding races and going from there since 2013. So this is our starting on our 11th year of putting on races.
That's cool. So are you technologist then with the timing company? Were you developing software?
No, and that was kind of some of the scary parts of the timing. I worked in a bank in IT, but I managed IT, which means I didn't really know anything. I just was able to manage the team that actually did. So all my partners were technical and they were developers. So they developed a system. We actually had online registration as well, so we could get all that data. And so we would go out and time the races. And as long as everything worked great, it was awesome. But as soon as something bad happened, I was immediately on the phone or calling, you know, texting whatever the my smarter partners, and they had to go in and troubleshoot and fix things on the fly. So there was a lot of stress, like when the first runner would hit the finish mat, we're like, okay, we're good. But if we weren't good immediately, it was going to be a bad day. Yeah. So we had a few bad days for sure.
That's kind of how 200s go. As long as everything's going great, they're great.
Yeah.
It's just, that's not really how it works.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I kind of prefer to have a little bit more control over things like that. So when things go bad, I like to be able to fix them. So that was a little bit exciting and scary all at once every time. So
that makes sense. So you've created Go Beyond Racing. You have a number of races. What inspired you to make that leap to 200s and create the Oregon 200?
Yeah. Renee, you want to, we have sure. A little bit different opinion on this, but she's
different memories of how it came to be.
Let's hear both.
Well, people have been asking us for years to develop one. They were saying they wanted alternatives and options and wanted us to put one on. And at the time, our longest distance that we produced was 100 miler. And I was just like, I am so exhausted after 100 miler. I can't imagine producing a 200 mile race. And so I was pretty resistant for a while to the idea. And then when COVID hit and we got shut down and had a little bit of free time, that's when we really started thinking about it seriously. Mm-hmm. And that's where we decided to go ahead and do it in 2020.
That's pretty, I guess that's really pretty consistent with my remembrance of it as well. So,
and, you know, like, I guess, how do you even start such a process? You know, I feel like, I don't know, I've obviously never been a race director. I've raced plenty of hundreds and 200s. And it just seems like you said, Renee, like putting on a 100 seems really hard, but I can kind of wrap my head around it. It's taking place during this, like, you know, 1 day plus 1.5 day, like, time frame. And now we're talking about, you know, 3, 4, 5 days. Just the logistical nightmare of it seems so much more involved. You know, when you finally decide to make that leap in 2020, what is like step one? How do you, you know, make that jump from 100 to say, all right, now we're going to put on a multi-day 3, 4, 5 day race?
Yeah, there was a lot of driving around, a lot of riding bikes around, a lot of running around, trying to figure out.
We knew the area where we wanted to do. We knew we were familiar with the Middle Fork Trail, which kind of was the start of this whole course, was to use that trail. That's outside Oak Ridge. It's a 50K distance trail, and we knew that it would be an awesome. There were zero events, running events happening on it. And so we knew we wanted to incorporate that. We also had volunteered with an organization called the Oregon Timber Trail, which is a bike packing trail that runs the entire state of Oregon. And we were interested in that route and figuring out how we could incorporate that route into something to make a longer race. So like Todd said, it was a lot of time on maps, a lot of time driving around. We ran a whole bunch of trails. We biked a whole bunch of trails, piecing together, like, this is great. This is not great. This would work. This would be awesome, but there's no way vehicles can get here. So we couldn't do this. And so it was a lot of time developing it. It was a good thing that came out of COVID for us, because otherwise we never would have had the time available to put into creating that.
So can you walk us through the inaugural year? How did it go? What are some highlights, maybe some learnings?
Yeah. And the first year was really amazing. It was great. And I think it exceeded our expectations in a lot of ways. I realized, like, 2 days into it, I'm like, this is the most fun I've had as a race director in any race. And, really, everyone's like, really? Why? Why is that? And I think it's just a matter of being able to see all of the stuff that we'd worked on for, a couple, 2-3 years kind of come together was a big part of it. But also just the ability to stop and talk with volunteers and talk with the runners and talk with crew and have, more than a 5-second conversation, is a big deal. Because in other races, you see a lot of people, meet a lot of people, and you have really quick conversations, but you're not really able to have a long conversation or really get to know people as well. But this one was much more like that for us, for me anyway. And, it was just pretty amazing to see all the volunteers, all the ham radio operators, mm-hmm. Come together. Like, we didn't know if we were going to have enough people or how you feel, how do you feel a time slot when a normal volunteer shift is maybe 2 or 3 hours and you need 5 days worth of people and they're out there for 24 hours or 12 hour shifts it was pretty amazing to see all that happen. So for me, it was an amazing experience. And also it was very motivational, very motivating for me to see the runners too, because, I didn't really know what to expect. To see some people just like fight through stuff and just keep going and going and going and going. It was amazing. I know that for the next couple months when I'd go out on runs and I would feel a little bit like, I'm kind of over it. I'm like, nope, I'm going some more, because just from the people I saw at the race. So it was amazing.
Yeah. I think one thing that I really love about the distance is, regardless of where you are in the race, if you're trying to win it or you're at the very back of the pack, you do have a little more time to like just do everything. And like that's where those relationships come in. Like this smaller 200 community, everyone knows each other, and it's like everyone's very accessible and approachable. And like, the first place runner is spending time sitting at the aid station eating a cheeseburger, just like the last place runner. Whereas like in 100, there's a little bit more disparity. And like, the back of the pack might be doing that, but the front of the pack's, pouring their tailwind in and getting going.
They don't even carry a headlamp.
right. I guess as the race directors, and Mountain Lakes is how many years old? It's been around quite a while.
We've been doing it since 2013.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's over a decade. Like, so you're used to that distance and those challenges. Like, what surprised you at Oregon 200? Obviously a lot less sleep, I'd imagine, but like, what were the big, like, oh man, this is next level. Like, were there any like moments or challenges that came up that were like so out of left field compared to something like a 100-miler?
Yeah. And a lot of people talk about the sleep. For me, it was, it's a different type of, not sleeping. And that is at 100. I usually stay up the entire time until we close down. So it's like a longer period of time. Whereas the 200, you're getting, a little bit of sleep every day, or we should be. and so that part of it wasn't much harder, really. There was a few times during the race when I really had no idea what day it was, because we'd be like, oh, we saw you yesterday. No, 2 days. Was it 3 days ago? Yeah. You don't know what day it is and that sort of thing. So that's orientation is kind of gone. There's a lot more stuff, a lot more gear, and a lot more those types of things to organize. Once that is done and the race gets going, it's really just a matter of, reacting to the race and making sure that everybody has what they need. And it's a lot more stuff, but really the organization's not that much different, I don't think, than a 100-miler. It just transpires over a longer period of time. And people are a lot less, if you don't have one thing at an aid station, it doesn't ruin someone's day, because they can get over it and just move on to the next aid station. So
Yeah, in the weeks leading up to the race, it was pretty stressful because we knew we were undertaking a pretty big thing, and that it was, really important to the people who were signing up to run this. And so we had a lot of pressure that we put on ourselves to, make sure that we were going to deliver the kind of race we wanted it to be. And so that was a lot of self-imposed anxiety. Mm. And then, in the days leading up to the week leading up to the race and getting the course marked and all the signage out for the crew and just all that stuff, and not ever having done this particular race before, thinking our timing was going to be right. Like, we need to start marking on this day and, set out the crew directional signs on this day, but not too far in advance because we didn't want somebody to come and, steal them, which we've had happen before, or change them around and send people down the wrong road. And so there was just a lot of anxiety. But like Todd said, once we said go and the runners took off and we saw the little trackers moving along, it was like a relief, like, okay, it's happening. We did it. It's happening and people are running. And then, oh, wait, look, there's people going off course already. So, yeah.
I agree. I think that once the race started, it felt very, similar to mm-hmm. a normal race. But for me, that year leading up to the race was definitely the hardest year for me as a race director and the most stressful. Felt like, I've said this before, I felt like we did two race seasons on top of each other. The 200 was almost like an entire year of race preparation, and we still did the other races as well. So one of the reasons I enjoyed it as much as I did was because it was a huge relief for it to actually just start mm-hmm. and go and then be successful. So there was definitely a lot of preparation up front, but once the race got started, it was great.
Well, I imagine that, all that stress, anxiety, and preparation kind of, in a way, made you like over-deliver. At least, from my perspective, what I've heard from people who have run the race is that it was some of the best aid stations they've ever seen at a 200, which is saying something because like the destination aid stations, the Cocodona aid stations are like phenomenal. It's like full service mm-hmm. diners, medical, sleep, whatever you need. So I obviously haven't seen yours, but that is what I heard. So that's, a testament to like, that you did deliver on what people needed and expected. And I think, Todd, to your point, like in general, at least speaking personally and from my friends, like 200 runners are a little more resilient when it comes to that stuff. And like, if you don't have what they need at the aid station, well, oh, bummer, I'll get it at the next one. Like, there's nothing they can't live without for one right. stretch. Whereas I maybe less experienced or shorter ultras, it's like, they let that really get to them and kind of impact their race.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time talking to people that we knew had run 200s ahead of time, like finding out what was great, what we should definitely, mm-hmm. Have at the race, what we should definitely not do. So we really put a lot of time into figuring out what we needed to do and the areas that we needed to really focus on to exceed people's expectations, like food, our menu. We put so much thought into the menu for the aid stations with the type of entrees, we called them, that we were serving, and making sure that, we had vegan options at every aid station, vegan and vegetarian and gluten-free options. Like we had so much food at the aid stations.
And trying to think through like, okay, we need to consider the volunteers serving this and how are they going to serve it and how long can it be in a chafing dish safely and all that sort of thing. So we probably spent about 80% of our time just focused on the food, I think.
Yeah. We made like little recipe cards for the volunteers, like how you cook. We served yakisoba at one of our aid stations. And it's like how you chop the vegetables, how you, how much sauce to put in it. It's like we wanted it to be very well done.
Well, I think we all appreciate the effort there. It makes me want to run your race even more. Just food is such a challenge for runners out there. It's like, it's so hard to eat as you get deeper into this race.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. We definitely tried hard to have a good variety of food because we knew that after a while, you're just like not into it. Yeah. And the crew access was another thing that we spent a lot of time on. We'd heard from other people how other crews, we talked to not just runners, but we talked to people who had crewed 200s to find out what was good and bad. And just hearing about the driving nightmares and being lost in the middle of the night, you know, on forest roads and, you know, no internet, no cell service. And so that was a big part of what we wanted to focus on, is making the course very crew accessible and as easy as we possibly could make it for people to get from aid station to aid station and even back to like Oak Ridge. You know, you go out on the course for a while, you can come back into Oak Ridge. And so we...
Part of our trail marking included actually putting arrows and things out on the roads for the crew to get the to and from aid station. So
yeah.
Nice. So one of my favorite parts of 200s is just the vast amount of land, you know, you're covering, as you can see all sorts of different climates and, you know, different types of vegetation. So, you know, can you walk us through some of the highlights of what the Oregon 200 covers? You know, it looks like it goes through a couple national forests, but like, what are those must-see areas it goes through?
Yeah, no, for me, the my favorite part of running and also my favorite part of this course is just running in big forest, you know, big trees on a nice trail near a body of water. That's kind of the magic thing for me. And the turnaround for this race is at along the North Umpqua Trail. And we put a race there, 100K and a 50K, a number of years ago. And so we knew the area pretty well. But there are some just magical spots along that 16-mile, it ends up being 32 miles out and back, section with huge trees, big waterfalls, a river that goes through.
A really pretty river.
Beautiful river. Yeah. And amazing basalt column waterfalls down the side as you're running. And so for me, that's the most amazing part. It's not the easiest part of the course, maybe the hardest part, but it's also the most beautiful, I think.
Most technical terrain on that section.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the course is primarily on the North Umpqua River Trail and then the Middle Fork of the Willamette River Trail. And as Todd said, they both are running along a river. So you're surrounded the whole time. You've got water nearby. You can hear the water, the river, you know, flowing by. I like the Middle Fork Trail a lot. And when you get off of the Middle Fork, where actually the headwaters of the Middle Fork is a lake called Timpanogos Lake. And we have an aid station there right on the lake. And then the runners go do a 10-mile section, a 10-mile loop around that lake. It's a small lake, but they go wider around the lake. And then there's a teeny tiny little lake that you come upon that we send you around called Indigo Lake. And that is my favorite spot. It's just amazingly beautiful, just this beautiful little lake. You've got the Sawtooth Mountain there with this really neat rock structure, the way it's all the rock has like calved off, broken off, and made this small talus slope that you get to cross at the end of the lake. It's a really, really pretty section. Hopefully you get to do it in the daylight. That's the thing, like with a race this distance, you know, some people are going to hit sections in the dark that you really wish they could see in the daylight. That Indigo Lake area is just beautiful.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. Like, you know, I've done Cocodona twice and I've always hit Sedona at night.
Oh, no.
And like, I know Sedona well, I know what it looks like, but like, it's arguably the most like striking and beautiful part of that course. And it's just, you know, pitch black. Every year I run Bigfoot, I'm told that like Mount Margaret and the first day of like that area is just the most beautiful part of the course, but I always get there around midnight and it's just like, it's, you know, we do these things because it's beautiful. And then sometimes you just, you know, have to view it by headlamp. So that's funny that you guys say that. I wanted to talk kind of briefly about the, is it the Cedar Creek fire? Mm-hmm. I know, you know, having run 200s for a few years now, it seems like climate change is becoming like a player in these races because they're so big and they cover so much land. It's like, you know, Cocodona in 22 had to do some crazy last minute rerouting with a fire that popped up very suddenly and near the race. Like, how did you guys handle that? What changes did it cause you to make? And had like, how do you view that moving forward? Like, will there be significant changes in 24?
Yeah, so the course that we have now wasn't our initial course. Let's see, about 60 some miles, or I can't remember now. But yeah, initially what we had planned was a it was like a letter C, where you start at one point and you go to the other end of the C, but then back to the middle. That probably doesn't make any sense. But anyway.
You drew it on the screen.
Yeah, I drew it with my fingers, so you can hear. Yeah, we had a course that was going to start near a lake called Crescent Lake and travel all the way to Oak Ridge using the Middle Fork Trail and then up to another lake called Waldo Lake and go all the way around the lake and then come back on this area called Bunchgrass Ridge. And the Cedar Creek fire burned around the Waldo Lake area and the Bunchgrass Ridge. And so that part of the course, which was about half of it, about 100 miles of that, was inaccessible to us. And so that's when the course became an out and back, and when we incorporated the North Umpqua River Trail to be able to make up the difference. So we've dealt with multiple fires on this course. There was actually a little fire the year before, just outside of Oak Ridge, that cut off the trail we were going to use to access the Bunchgrass Ridge. So we had a reroute before the Cedar Creek fire even happened. So yeah, you're right. Fires are definitely a part of all races, not just the 200 miler. We have considerations for fire in many of our races now.
Do you plan to go back to that original course eventually, the C-shaped one, or are you just kind of locking in this new one?
We'd like to. That area, the Bunchgrass Ridge area, is special to us. We actually, a few years back, we had been thinking about the 200 on this route at that time, did a weekend-long volunteer work with the Oregon Timber Trail folks to cut down trees to start a new trail corridor. So we were helping make a connector over to the Waldo Lake area trails from the Bunchgrass Ridge area trails. And now it's been made for us. There probably aren't many trees in that section left, but we would like to, but that part isn't even, as far as I know, open back to the public yet. So it would be a little while before. But the good thing that came out of that is that course was going to have, you know, a portion that was an out and back section. Right now, the course that we've got is 100 miles out, 100 miles back. And one thing that we've learned from that is that it's actually pretty cool that way. People tell us they like being able to see runners, that in a lot of other 200s point to point, you're out there by yourself for so long, you don't, you know, get to see as many people. And so with the out and back, there's more opportunity to see the other runners, and the crew have a much easier task when they only have a 100-mile distance that they have to cover, getting runners both ways on it.
So. And we get to incorporate the North Umpqua Trail too, which was a little surprise bonus. So that was great.
But for 2024, it'll be the same course as it was last year with a couple minor little tweaks.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I understand why, like, out and backs have a bad rap, and people would rather do like a single non-repetitive race, which I totally get. I'm to an extent the same way for sure. You know, the point to point and the loop has its allures. But like, whenever I do an out and back, I'm reminded of the pros, which, you know, you guys have touched on, like it's so much easier on crews. There is a really cool sense of camaraderie that at some point you do get to see the entire field. Mentally, it's really nice to like reach a point and then start heading home. Like, you know, it kind of segments the race. So there's definitely some pros there. And going back to our previous point, you might get to see something in the daytime that you had passed through at night. So I was going to
mention that too. You may be running through an area that you ran before, but you have no idea because you didn't see it at night. We were actually doing some trail work early this week on a trail that we run every Tuesday night. We run this trail, but one direction. And so we were doing the trail work in the opposite direction. I'm like, where are we? And like, it was all almost disorienting. Like, but it was on a trail I'd probably run 500 times, but the same direction. So sometimes just a change like that and the perspective can completely make it new.
So I've heard, it's kind of an oxymoron, but I've heard Oregon 200 kind of referred to as a good beginner 200, you know, and I can see, based on some of the things you've said, a lot of things that make that true. I'm curious to hear what you think about that reputation, but I wanted to touch on, you know, you mentioned how crew accessible it is, which, you know, looking at some of the other 200s out there, just by nature of where they are very not crew accessible. And, you know, having crewed them myself, it is quite a challenge to be a good crew when you're having a hard time taking care of yourself and finding things and all that. So, you know, I think it's really cool that you're like putting crew directions out there and making it like feel like the crew is, you know, welcomed and invited, because at some places, not to any fault of the race, but it almost feels like they're not, you know, whether it's Forest Service regulations or just space issues and stuff like that. So, you know, how many times do runners get to see their crew on the course, and how, you know, have you kind of like sold that as like a selling point for this race?
Yeah, I think one thing when we think about putting on a race, there are a couple of things we consider, but especially for the 200, you know, not only, you know, what's the runner's experience, but also what's the crew experience and what's the volunteer experience. Those are all, you know, I don't know if they're equally important, but they're all
very important.
As important. And so we went into this one looking at, you know, getting as many crew accessible spots on the course as possible, without impacting, number one, other forest users. So for example, the aid stations that were at campgrounds, we would avoid using them as crew access spots certain times of the day. But yeah, just really looking at making all of the aid stations or as many of the aid stations crew accessible as possible without creating bottlenecks and crowding and that sort of thing.
Yeah, the only aid station that isn't crew accessible is the second one on the way out. On the way back, it is, but on the way out, just because everybody's still kind of bunched up a little more and it is right beside a campground. And so having massive crew show up early on in the race when people are still a little more congested, we knew wasn't going to be very, very good for the other users in the area. And so that one isn't crew accessible, but all the others are.
Another thing that was sort of turned out to be something that was a kind of a bonus for the crew is we had Starlink at our aid stations. We had a couple aid stations that had cell coverage, but most didn't. And so we had Starlink set up, and thinking that was going to be, number one, a backup kind of safety net for communications, but also for us as race operations to be able to communicate better. But it turned out that for the crew, you know, they could check in and see where their runner was when they got there. And
check in on the live tracking to see where their runner was or wasn't.
And some people watched football a little bit too, but that wasn't the intention. But that's another, it ended up being kind of a bonus for the crew. But, you know, to the your point about is it a beginner 200? We love putting on events where people experience things for the first time. That's kind of, we like that. And we thought this, you know, setting it up for making it crew accessible and, you know, kind of a more intimate sort of setting would make it easier for people. You know, we had some runners, one guy that has done a bunch of 200s, he's like three quarters of the way through, he goes, "This is a graduate level 200. You needed to warn people how hard this was. It looks easy, but it's so hard." And we got a little bit of feedback that we should have had some sort of hurdle, I guess, for beginner 200s to enter this race. And I got a little bit upset about that. And I said, you know, we want to have it a situation where somebody can go way above and beyond what they have done before and achieve something. And so I mentioned that at the post-race party, and it turned out that the finisher rate for first time 200 runners was it's just barely higher than for the experienced folks. So
yeah, we didn't go into it thinking we were creating a course that was, you know, first time friendly, but we had a good number of people, you know, because we have people that run our races that have been asking for 200. So there were a bunch of people doing their first 200, and it was a good, you know, first one for them. And that reputation, I think, you know, has gotten out there, and we are 100% okay with that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not an easy race.
But we also like it when people are a little surprised at how hard things are too. So we probably wouldn't have incorporated the North Umpqua Trail or some of the other trails if we wanted to make it the easiest 200, mm-hmm. you know, some more flat Forest Service roads or something, but we're okay with that reputation.
Mm-hmm. I guess a couple things I wanted to point out that you said is one is that Starlink is huge. Just, you know, myself having crewed, when you don't have cell service, you just feel so disconnected and you know, you're not at ease. So I think, you know, that's a huge bonus, you know, for anyone crewing this race. And then a second thing is, you say it's a little bit beginner friendly or not as challenging, but I think that still draws a lot of folks out regardless of experience level, because, you know, people want to chase how fast can they do this distance, right? So I think I think we've seen that in the hundreds, you know, people shooting for 24 hours in certain races. And I imagine we might see trends like that in the 200 space.
Well, we've got last year's winner is coming back this year because he wants to do it faster.
But it's still 200 miles, people. Yeah.
What was his finish time?
Oh, last year's finish time was 56 hours and 45 minutes.
I could beat that.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, and he, Benjamin is his name, and he came off of Fat Dog.
Nice. A
couple weeks before.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and that's a gnarly one.
Yeah, he wasn't exactly rested.
So maybe switching gears, sort of the future of your race organization and the 200 itself is what do you envision that this race becomes?
Yeah, we love the area and we think it's important to keep it in the area. We talked a little bit earlier about whether the course would go back or change to what we had originally envisioned or not, but we definitely like it being kind of Oak Ridge, Oregon focused and that being the hub of the race. So that I don't think would change at all. We talk about this a lot, you know, it's like, do we want to have, you know, giant races with a bunch of people and have, you know, a bunch of employees? We kind of prefer the smaller races because we get to know people a little bit better. That's just kind of our style. No disrespect to anybody who has a successful business. I'm not somebody like that at all. I mean, obviously we'd like this race to grow in terms of the number of people participating, but I don't ever really envision this being, you know, 500 people or anything like that, just because of how we like to put on events.
Yeah. We've been doing this for, you know, 10 years now. And so we're fortunate that we can put on the type of events that we want to, you know, to put on and that bring us joy and are rewarding for the runners as well as us and the community and the, you know, just being able to have relationships with the people when they're out running, like Todd was saying, being able to talk with folks and spend time with them and runners and crew and the local community there in Oak Ridge. That's more important to us.
Something kind of intimate and artisanal. We like we always use that word when things are small and kind of we have to do it ourselves. We call it artisanal. Yeah,
I like it. Oregon 200, the artisanal 200.
Yeah. There you go.
New tagline.
Yeah. So, I mean, to that point, you guys are open for registration. Someone could sign up right now for this year's race, right?
Yep.
What is the cap? What do your permits allow?
We're going to cap this one less than our permit allows. I think we said, was it one or 150?
Well, we don't actually, permits are not done for the 2024, but we, last year we asked for a permit for 150 runners. So, but I don't think we'd go that high just based on what we learned from last year. I don't know that we'll be able to go that high in terms of just being able to support everyone the way we want to on that course.
Sure. That's fair. Well, I think, you know, I think I saw you guys posted a couple of days ago, you know, if you're on one of the 200 wait lists and you're 200 curious, which is a term we used in the last episode here, 200 curious. I mean, Oregon to me looks like a great beginner race. The trails look, you know, having run out in Oregon, not on those trails, but they look a lot more forgiving and less just like violent than some of the desert rocky, you know, trails like that. And it sounds like a great option for someone to be able to just kind of throw their name in and go give this distance a shot, because it's, you know, anyone who, the biggest hurdle in a 200, in my opinion, you know, assuming you're able to train and able to afford it, is just wanting to complete the distance, like truly wanting to get to that finish line.
Yeah. You revisit that thought often during the race. Do I really want to do this? You have to want to.
So what advice would you offer, you know, some of these first time runners signing up for Oregon 200?
Well, just that. I mean, you're going to have this conversation a lot. Like, this sounds terrible to say, but I think anybody could run 100 miles if they wanted to. And obviously some people have limitations and that sort of thing, but you see people that run 100 miles or 200 miles and I'm always amazed by some of the people that do it. And I think if you really want to do it and you're motivated to do it, you can do it. And you just have to keep reminding yourself that, because, you know, whether it's 2 hours in or 12 hours in or, you know, 3 days in, you're going to get to a point where you're like, it's going to be a lot easier to stop. But just keep reminding yourself that you can do it. I mean, that's my advice. It's not very probably new or whatever, but I think it's true.
I would add that, especially for people who don't have experience at the 200 distance or even the 100 mile distance, there was somebody last year who had never run a 100 miler who was running the 200 miler, but learn to be good at hiking. People are like, you run 200 miles. No, you don't run the whole time. Well, I wonder if anybody has ever run entire time. Yeah.
But close to it, but
of any 200, but just hone those hiking skills and become friends with the hiking aspect, because that's going to be a big, big chunk of time we'll be hiking, not running.
I think that's real. I mean, I hear that advice often, but I'm not sure that recipients of that advice truly take it to heart, because like the leg activation, especially from the knee down when you're hiking versus running, is so different.
Yes.
And if you haven't done that significantly in training, you're going to have some calf, Achilles, shin, ankle issues. Like, it's just a totally different motion. And if all of a sudden you go from never really doing that to doing it for 50 of 100 hours, your body's going to have some things to say about that.
Yeah. I think, too, just being kind to yourself and knowing that a lot of your plans are going to change along the way. One of the kind of most interesting conversations after the races are always like, how much did you sleep? What was your plan for sleeping? And not everyone has a plan, but most people have a plan going in, and probably no one actually executes that plan exactly in terms of sleeping or when you sleep or whatever. And so I think you just have to be super adaptable and just kind to yourself and not get too hung up on small things. And also know, and I give people advice in a 100 miler when they're think they need to stop at mile 70. I'm like, you could sit here for 3 hours and take a nap, get up and go run. And your time's not going to be what you wanted it to be, but you'll have finished 100 miler. In the same case for a 200, you have 2 days, you could sleep and recover and just get out of your mind for a little bit, just relax, chill out, and then start again, because you have plenty of time to catch up and keep going. So
I would also say that volunteer or crew at one, just so you can see what it's like, because it is a little bit different than, you know, some of the other races that people will have participated in. So just volunteer at an aid station, especially the overnight, you know, shifts. Those are often eye-opening for folks who are thinking about doing a longer distance when they see what the runners, you know, what shape they're in when they come in, what they need. Versus what, you know, you think they might have needed.
Yeah.
So seeing it from the other side first, I think, is helpful.
Yeah, volunteering is very eye-opening and a great experience, even if you are not interested in running a 200-miler, just to see that side of it. How can people volunteer for the Oregon 200? Do you guys have, is it just contact you, or do you guys have a sort of official process? Or
yeah, there's a link on the website where you can, it's right next to registering. You can register on Ultra Sign Up, but also on Ultra Sign Up, there's a link to volunteer as well, right next to register for the race. And it goes to a site called ivolunteer.net.com, but that's the best way to volunteer.
And there's a page on the Oregon 200 webpage, the website, that has a volunteer section with a button there, trying to make it easy for everybody.
Cool. And, you know, one thing, we are super lucky out here. We have an amazing, amazing group of volunteers that volunteer at our races and all the races out here. And we had an amazing crew this last year, and It's not 100% official yet, but I think every single aid station captain from last year is coming back to captain again. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a pretty exciting to have people out there who've been there before and that want to come back. And some of the aid stations are already full, so it's great.
Cool. That's a testament to how fun it can be to just be out there helping others. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Todd, before we hit record here, you said you had some questions for us. I'd love to love to hear what those were.
Well, one of the kind of possibly coming later questions I was going to ask you, what is the best gear for a 200-mile crew member? Best single piece of gear? Like you have someone on your crew, you're like, don't forget that. Is there something?
I have a really good fold-up chair, like one of those like chairs that you can recline in that doesn't take up a ton of space. I mean, that's one that I'd recommend for the crew and one that I'd want to use myself. Like I look forward to that. Like I fantasize about that chair when I'm 16 miles out. So that's what comes top of mind to me. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah. Chair, blankets, like it gets cold out there just sitting around at night. Like crew should have headlamps. Crew needs a way to charge their own things. So some of it's maybe similar to what racers do, but.
Yeah, you almost need to prepare like the racer and realize that like, you know, 60 degrees, 55 at night can feel much colder when you're just sitting around doing nothing than it might seem.
For sure. Yeah. And realizing that you're going to not be in your car when you need to charge something. So have some way of charging something on your own that's mobile.
Cool. Let's hop into our quick five, which you just alluded to. Todd, we'll make this race director specific. So like speaking as a race director, not a runner, you guys can take turns, both answer however you prefer, but kind of top of mind, whatever comes to mind when I ask. So what's the highest high you guys have ever had in a race?
So last year at our Volcanic 50 race, which is the 50K that we have that circumnavigates around Mount St. Helens, when we were out marking the course, we always mark the course. There's a 50K and a 25K. And we had a couple people that were going to do, Todd and someone were going to do the 50K, and I and someone else were going to mark the 25K. And the course is the same for the first 6 miles. And right as we were nearing where we were going to split, the person that was going to mark with Todd tripped, hit her head on a lava rock, and banged up her knee pretty badly. And it was just not safe for her to continue on because that route is very isolated.
Super remote.
There's no car access. And so we had to quickly pivot. And I was planning to mark 25K that day. I didn't have sunglasses. I didn't have enough.
Or sunscreen.
Fuel or anything. But I got to jump in and join Todd to mark the 50K, which was a highlight of my year because I hadn't been able to go around St. Helens in a couple years since the pandemic, actually. And so that was a huge high for me to be able to spend the day marking that with Todd. That was super fun. Hmm. Loved it. And the woman was fine that bonked her head. That ended up being a non-issue, and her knee is much better.
All right. How about lowest low in a race?
I don't really have a low for a race specifically, but COVID was a little rough just because when it started happening, it just wasn't really very clear how we were going to come out of it. And then even after we started to, like the possibility of races coming, you know, there were all these new ways of doing things that just didn't feel like, you know, they should. So that period of time was a little rough. We did some virtual races, but that to me was like kind of the low of the last 10 years for sure.
Yeah. This is what we do. This is how we make our living. This is how we feed our kids. And so when we were faced with what ended up being a year plus of not being able to do that, that was pretty sad.
Honestly, I don't really have really any good examples of a low in a race. I mean, there are times when people go off course and, you know, you feel terrible about it. We had to cancel the Mountain Lakes 100 the first year because a typhoon came and we had to stop it midway through. So that in a way was a low, but then the way we were able to kind of rally everybody and get everyone off the course safely became sort of a high in a sense. So it's really hard to come up with things that are not like amazing in our, as a race director, just because, you know, we could be working in a building right now doing paperwork or whatever. And,
in a cubicle.
And we get to do what we're doing. So even the lows are highest in a lot of ways. So,
okay. What about if you guys could create a race anywhere in the world, you know, the race would be successful. Where would that race be?
I think about the Timberline Trail. It's a 40-mile loop that goes all the way around Mount Hood, just like our volcanic goes around Mount St. Helens, but it's in wilderness, so events aren't allowed. But otherwise, we've both run it, and it's an amazing route. And if we could have a race there, we would definitely would have had a race there by now.
Yeah, for sure. I don't have a specific location, but the ideal race for me really is just a long, maybe almost flat to downhillish cruiser trail with big trees next to a river. And then when you get done, there's just a big party at the end and lots of parking.
Lots of parking.
But still remote.
Yeah, I almost did the Timberline Trail once. So that's on my list to eventually do.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Peter and I traveled out to, we actually stayed in the Timberline Lodge. We went to sleep expecting to wake up and do the trail. And Peter woke up puking his guts out, food poisoning. So I just went and did a bunch of different runs from the lodge and did my own thing while Peter laid in bed all day.
Oh, wow. No. Oh, yeah. You need to come back and try again.
Yeah, it's an amazing run.
Okay. And then the last question that we ask everyone, have you found your distance to empty yet?
I'm going to say no.
Cool. I know no one said yes yet.
That's good.
I mean, we keep doing this. And so as far as race directing, you know, I assume that's what you meant. As far as race directing goes, we're still doing it. The fact, I guess, that we decided to put on a 200-mile race after, you know, all the other events that we've done over the years means that we still have some gas in the tank.
But there are a lot of times when we're putting on an event and we think we're done and there's something else that happens that you just have to do. And then you don't even think twice, you just do it. And again, kind of part of the, like, it's an amazing thing to be able to do for a living. It's just, you just do it. I don't know. I want to say there are endless things that you could have to do after a race, but no, I don't think I've found empty yet. So still.
We had an experience once at a race where we got word the night before the race was to start. Actually, this was another volcanic story. We do have other races too, but volcanic, all the aid stations are hike-in only. It's all remote. Everything is carried into the aid stations by the volunteers. And we got word the night before when a runner showed up. I think they told us, hey, two volunteers aren't going to be able to make it tomorrow. And because everything is hiked in, two bodies not showing up means stuff can't get carried in. And so after marking the course and setting everything up, that night, like 10 o'clock at night, we grabbed a few friends who were around and we hiked in the supplies to the aid station, utterly exhausted already, but a four mile hike up the mountain to deliver the aid station supplies. So I think that's an example, Todd was saying, where you keep going because you kind of have to.
And it sort of became one of the high points of the year, honestly, just because it was just so a glorious night with stars and the moon up there. Mm-hmm. And you're there at 1 o'clock at night or whatever. And it's just amazing.
Awesome. I wanted to give a quick shout out to Kristen Hansen, who facilitated this this chat on Instagram. I think Kristen's run and volunteered at a bunch of your races and is doing her first 200 at Oregon this year.
Yes.
So thank you, Kristen, for getting this introduction and making this happen. Thank you.
We know her well.
Yeah. Thanks, Todd and Renee, for being here. So I think people can find out more at gobeyondracing.com. Oregon 200, obviously, is on Ultra Sign Up and their website. And it's also Go Beyond Racing on Instagram. Is that correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks, guys. Oregon 200. It's on our list. Hopefully, it's on everyone who's listening.
Great.
Can't wait to see you there.
Well, the Oregon 200 is certainly on my list now. That was really cool.
Yeah, I agree. There's no such thing as an easy 200, but I think it's exciting that there's, you know, one where you can really push yourself to go for a time. So I think, you know, that it is close to 200, and I think we could really see some amazing times here over the years. And I'd love to challenge myself and see how fast I can actually go 200 miles.
Yeah, and my limited experience running out there on those trails, they're just so runnable and smooth and like not super technical. So you really can just kind of run the whole time and, or, you know, as much as one can during a 200. And yeah, it just sounds like they take really good care of their runners, really good care of the crews. It's, you know, I've heard from other runners who have done it that the food is just, you know, like the best they've had, which is saying a lot because the food at the other 200s are really good. So yeah, pretty cool. Kudos to Todd and Renee.
All right. So what do we have first?
Well, first up, we have a special offer from Todd and Renee at the Oregon 200. They are, through the end of March, they are giving $100 off registration for the Oregon 200 for this year, for 2024, to any listeners of Distance to Empty. So the code for that registration is distance2empty, the number 2, not the word 2. So distance, the number 2, empty. And I believe the D and the E are capitalized. Not sure if that matters, but that's how the code came through. So yeah, if you're looking for a 200 and, you know, the other ones are sold out, or, you know, don't want to deal with lotteries, hop into the Oregon 200. It's in a beautiful part of the country, and they put on a really good race over there at Go Beyond Racing. So thanks to Todd and Renee for extending that offer to our listeners, and we hope some of you take advantage of it. All right, should we get into some categories?
Let's do it.
All right, I'll take performance of the week this week. So we have a very distance to empty, appropriate performance of the week this week. I want to talk about the Lululemon Further project, which just happened this past weekend. So there were 10 women who were, you know, pushing their limits, trying to hit their personal best in distance over a 6-day looped course race. And out of those 10 women, I mean, all of them put in incredible mileage. And I think, you know, just to keep it applicable to this podcast, 7 of them were over 200 miles. So just really remarkable distances over, you know, a pretty compressed period of time. You know, definitely all of them did multi-day distances and events. And Camille Herron actually did 560 miles, I believe, which, you know, was a world record with many world records along the way during that time. So just incredible work from all those women. And like, I mean, talk about pushing boundaries in the multi-day 200 plus space.
Yeah, I agree. It's awesome that there's so many new formats where people can get to that 200 distance. It doesn't always have to be one of these mountainous races.
Oh, totally. And like anyone who's put in like even 100 mile week before, like, can appreciate like putting in that sort of distance over such a period of time. Like it's still like, in, you know, pretty insane to like log 200 miles over, you know, 10 days, 12 days, 14 days. Like it's still a, you know, like just a wild effort. So kudos to everyone who participated in the Further project. And yeah, if you hadn't seen it or followed it, check it out. It was pretty remarkable to follow and watch.
All right. So I think I'll get into a snack review.
Sweet.
So this week, I tried the Reese's Caramel Big Cup. I think this is our first one that's actually from the United States. But I guess it's a little bit more of a rare snack to find. And actually, I really like this one. It's a big, dense Reese's cup. It's 190 calories. It came in a resealable or a sealed package just for the one. So I think this is very applicable to Bean Race Fuel. Yeah, it tasted great. You can taste the caramel. I thought that tasted fine. So I think this would be, you know, when you get tired of gels and everything else, this is a great way to get in, you know, one of these per hour on top of what you're drinking would be a great way to fuel.
Yeah, I love snacks that are like individually packaged and right around that, like, you know, 200 calorie mark, just for that reason, because it's like takes the guesswork and the thinking out of it. You can kind of be like, all right, one of these and yeah, some Scratch or some Tailwind or whatever. So yeah, that was delicious. I ate my Reese's Caramel Cup like a month ago because I just couldn't resist. And since it was a US snack, not a like exotic snack from that bag we got, I was just like, whatever, I'm just going to eat this. So no self-control.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It's very good.
Yeah, but we did just order another bag, so we should have some fresh perspectives for future episodes here coming up. So cool. Let's get into our favorite category and play Let's Get Deep.
Let's Get Deep.
Let's Get Deep. Let's Get Deep is a question game for couples. Peter and I read them to each other on the podcast. There's three categories: icebreaker, deep, and deeper. I'll kick it off with your icebreaker, Peter. Going to the movies or watching a movie at home?
At this point, watching a movie at home. For a while there, actually before I got into running, I really geeked out on like home theater and all that. So I've got like the 5.1 setup and everything else. So I have a good setup at home, and it's just to take a family of four to the movies is like over $100. So even if I had to pay $20 to rent a new release, that's much better.
Yeah. Yeah. Having a family of four is like, you know, you got to take a mortgage out for everything you do.
Yeah. It's ridiculous. All right. Icebreaker for you. What's your favorite TV series of all time? Why?
Oh, hands down, The Office. And I feel like a lot of people say they're like an Office super fan. Like, I have a sleep headband that, like, you know, like has headphones in it. And I listen to episodes of The Office every night as I go to sleep, every single night. I can recall, you can give me a quote and I can tell you the episode and the season and, you know, like where it took place in the episode. Like, it's beyond an obsession. But I like a lot of shows. I'm a big TV guy.
Yeah, I've witnessed all of this. It's true.
All right, you're deep here. When is it most important for you to hear the words, "I love you"?
I think it's most important to hear that when the person that's telling me that is mad at me, so I know that everything's okay. We can move on from whatever.
Are people mad at you a lot, Peter?
It seems to be. I don't know why.
Okay.
All right, deep for you. If you could time travel, what time would you go to? Why?
Huh. I feel like I'd probably go, I don't know, maybe I'd be boring and just go back to like the early 90s or late 80s, like when I was a kid, and kind of like enjoy some of that nostalgia from my adult mind perspective. I feel like that's a boring answer, but that sounds fun to me.
I get it. I think I'd want similar.
Yeah. All right. You're deeper. Have you ever been to therapy? What was it like?
So yes, I have been to therapy. I think it was great. I think I've never had to take medicine or anything, but I definitely have had like anxiety problems and things around that. And I think definitely therapy helped get through those type of things. It's helpful just to be able to talk to someone and work through things. So yeah, I think therapy is a great idea.
Yeah. Like a non-biased sounding board.
Yep. All right. And deeper for you. Is there an area of life where you think you might be too picky?
I think the better question is there an area of life where you're not too picky? Definitely. I'd say the biggest thing that I'd focus in on here is food. I wish I was a much less picky eater. I'm very like particular in the way I eat, and like I don't like condiments. I like things like dry and boring and plain. And I feel like sometimes I'm missing out on things because of that, but I'm very set in my ways, and yeah, definitely too picky in that space.
Well, it makes it easy when you're around. I can just feed you what I feed my kids. So
exactly.
It's perfect.
It's like taking a family of five to the movies.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, that'll wrap it up for this episode of Distance to Empty. Hope you guys are stoked on Oregon 200. I know we are. I really hope some of you sign up for that race. There's room in it. And if you do, let us know. We'd love to follow your journey and offer any tips and support we can, especially if it's your first 200. Because as you heard, it is not an easy 200, but it is first-timer friendly, sort of by design, and just by the work that Todd and Renee have put in. So thanks for listening. Leave us a review, subscribe, follow wherever you're listening. We really appreciate every time we see a new one of those coming in. It just makes our day. So can't thank you enough for listening, and have a good one. See you next time.